Hello and welcome to the Library Cafe, a weekly program of table talk about research and the formation and circulation of knowledge. I'm Thomas Hill. I'm very delighted to have on the program today the two curators of the exhibition entitled The Art of Devastation, Medals and Posters of the Great War, currently on view in the Francis Lehman Loeb Art Center here at Vassar College until April 9th. They are Patricia Fagan, Philip Lynn Strauss Curator of Prints and Drawings at the Art Center, and Peter Van Alphen, Margaret Thompson Curator of Ancient Greek Coins at the American Numismatic Society in New York. Hello, Patty and Peter.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm excellent, thank you. So I have a question for both of you. Can either of you tell me how this show came together, since it features especially medals from the Numismatic Society's collections in New York, and it also includes works on paper, which is your specialty, Patty, and it's taking place here in Poughkeepsie at Vassar rather than in New York?
Well, a few years ago, back in 2014, the ANS launched a website called Art of Devastation, which is still up at numismatics.org/AOD. And this website aims to be a comprehensive database and research tool of World War I medals. And we launched the site a few years ago to coincide with the centennial of the beginning of the First World War. And, you know, at that time, there was a lot of activity in Europe commemorating the centennial, including exhibitions and various online initiatives and so forth. But, you know, as you can imagine, most of that was from the perspective of the Europeans. So, you know, I thought it would be good to try to organize something, especially an exhibit, that would shift the perspective to consider the U.S. experience instead, and to do this through the lens of medals, certainly, but also posters, which played a huge role in propaganda and so forth during the war. But the ANS doesn't have an exhibit space for what I had in mind. And as it happens, the ANS's executive director, Uta Vartenberg, knows the Francis Lehman Loeb Art Center quite well and is also friends with the director, James Mundy. So she suggested that I contact both James and Patricia, and the resulting collaboration has been fantastic.
Yeah, there's a lot of enthusiasm here about the show, and I have to say it's just a stunning show visually.
No, it really is. It really is. Yeah, I mean, the quality of the installation is just superb.
So the American Numismatic Society provided the medals, but it was Peter's idea, actually, to include the posters, yes?
Peter thought it would also be great to have some posters and or publications in the show. And I looked at the particular images of the medals that Peter was thinking about, and I was really enthusiastic about the satirical medals especially. I had never seen them before and wanted to know more about them, since satire is a very big interest of mine, and I wanted to present them and the other medals to our audiences, and so I strongly supported the idea for the show.
So in 1917, this is a show to mark the centennial of America's entry into the war in 1917. It also happens to be the anniversary of Edna St. Vincent Millay's graduation from Vassar, where we have a show in the library. Young people, and most of us actually anymore, tend not to be all that familiar with the First World War. I mean, we know the Second World War, surely. But the First World War sort of faded into memory the way the Korean War did, I suppose, in the Vietnam era. And this is surprising in a way when you consider how important that war was historically for Europe and America too, and that it propelled us into the modern world. You know, it was really a break for Europe, especially with the past. And it also propelled the United States into its status as a world power and sort of set the stage for what they call the American century. So the question is, how is it that we've developed this kind of amnesia with regard to the events that began in August 1914?
I'm sure that, you know, a lot of that really has to do with the fact that the Second World War itself was just on a scale much, much larger than even the First World War. You know, the Second World War was just that much more devastating and that much more cataclysmic, and also happened much more globally than the First World War did. But, you know, especially for the U.S., you know, it's important to keep in mind that we were involved in the Second World War for almost 4 years, whereas in the First World War we were involved for about 18 months. So, you know, we were involved for, you know, almost three times longer in the Second World War, but also this was a war that began, for those of us in the U.S. anyway, with an attack on U.S. soil at Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941, and then devolved into this massive conflict on two fronts, both in the Pacific and also in Europe. And it required, you know, just a tremendous amount of effort on everybody's part here in the U.S. in terms of helping with the war effort, you know, building tanks, planes, munitions, things of that sort. So, you know, it was just that much larger of an event. But also, you know, I think it's, you know, that there was a narrative that was, you know, running through that period as well, too, that the good fighting the evil, and, you know, the evil that, you know, we were fighting at the time, the Nazis, you know, just seemed that much more just nasty, frankly, than, you know, the Imperial Germans of the First World War. So then, of course, you know, the way that the Second World War ended with, you know, the U.S. dropping two atomic bombs on Japan, you know, which then catapulted us, you know, in the aftermath of the Second World War as, you know, a major nuclear armed superpower. I mean, it really, all of this, I think, really does overshadow how dramatic, you know, the changes were following the First World War, which really rather roughly yanked the world out of, you know, the Gilded Age and really just crushed a lot of, you know, what the world had been, you know, at the end of the 19th and beginning of the 20th centuries. I think it's just a matter of just the Second World War just overshadowing the First World War.
So, Peter, can you tell us about the American Numismatic Society in New York?
The society was founded in 1858 by a group of gentlemen who were basically collectors and decided they wanted to have a place to have regular meetings and also to build a collective collection and a library. And for the first 50 years or so of the society's existence, it bounced around various rented rooms in the city before a benefactor by the name of Archer Huntington built the society a permanent home up in Washington Heights at 155th and Broadway. And by that point, the collection had grown and the library had grown. And the society began to also engage in, you know, exhibitions and publications to a much larger degree than it had before. And, you know, through the course of the 20th century, the society's collections continued to grow. We now have about 800,000 objects, which makes us one of the largest collections in the world, certainly considered one of the top five numismatic collections in the world. And we also have a library of about 100,000 volumes as well. Certainly, I would say, the best numismatic library anywhere in the world.
So the Society has a research library, and you're something of a research institute, yes?
Yeah, and in fact, a lot of our activities today, I mean, we're less of a museum, although we do exhibit our coins, of course, and are more than happy to lend our material to other institutions for exhibitions. But a lot of our activities now are focused on publications such as books and periodicals, as well as lectures and academic seminars. And in fact, we have every summer during June and July a graduate course in numismatics. It's an 8-week course. Students like to call it the coin boot camp. We teach them methods, theories, and then let them work on a project for duration of the summer.
So scholars can come and use the American Numismatic Society library.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. As well as, you know, just people more broadly interested in coins. We do like to make our resources available to anyone with interest in numismatics, whether the academics or just people who are just generally interested in coins.
I'm trying to think of other numismatics collections in libraries and can't, so you must fill a gap, at least in the United States.
The only other comparable collection here in the States is at the Smithsonian. They've got a collection that's about twice as large as ours, but it's certainly not as accessible, you know, by means. In Europe, there are a number of comparable collections, you know, the British Museum, the Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris, the National Library in Brussels, and so forth. And these are collections that are available to researchers, and they also do have a smaller research library and so forth. But certainly here in the United States, there's no other institution comparable.
Apart from not knowing much anymore about the history of the First World War itself, we're especially unfamiliar with the internal American tensions and sometimes conflicts that took place in the United States in the years between the outbreak of the war in Europe in August of 1914 and the American entry into the war in 1917, when we were a nation of divided sympathies. There was a huge German population, for one, in the country, and there were strong feelings about both sides of the conflict, sympathies with the Entente, or the Allies, and with the Central Powers. And Peter, you talked about this in your lecture at the opening, and the historian Ross Wilson writes about it extensively in the catalog. The catalog, I should mention, was just absolutely splendid exhibition catalog. Wonderful piece of scholarship, incredibly stunning photographs. It's a hefty book, really something to be proud of. And the show excavates this internal history to a great extent, doesn't it?
Yeah, that was one of the hopes of this show, was really to bring these tensions that were starting to develop and evolve within U.S. society during those few years of U.S. neutrality between, you know, 1914 and 1917, especially. And one of the things to keep in mind is that, you know, the U.S. certainly did have this serious ongoing problem, you know, with racism throughout the 19th century, especially towards, you know, African Americans and Native Americans. But there was also this perennial problem of nativism, you know, that was pitching, you know, these so-called nativists, you know, those people who are mostly of European descent, who had been born here, who were standing up against basically the latest crop of immigrants, you know, who were fresh off the boat. And so, you know, there was some backlash throughout the later part of the 19th century, especially against, you know, Catholic, Chinese, Irish, Italians, I mean, pretty much everybody, you know, came off the boat. And in fact, you know, this is something that recent Martin Scorsese film, Gangs of New York, you know, was focusing on. And some of these tensions then also began to, you know, play out in immigration laws. I mean, like that Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882, for example. But a lot of these tensions, these ethnic and racial tensions, were sort of bubbling a little bit below the surface. You know, it was with the outbreak of the war in Europe, you know, where you had this great European war taking place on the other side of the Atlantic, that really then began.
A war, incidentally, that was brought about by just this kind of ethnic tension, yes?
Yeah, no, and you know, with the outbreak of the war, those here in the United States were basically forced to pick sides. You know, the Germans and the Austro-Hungarians on the one side, and then the British and the French on the other side. And by 1915, these tensions, as people began to pick sides here in the States, really began to boil over. And part of that had to do with the fact that there was more and more news reaching the U.S. of atrocities committed by Germans, both in central Belgium and northern France, but then also on the high seas with their submarine warfare.
Culminating with the sinking of the Lusitania.
Right, and you know, the Lusitania was a British passenger liner that sailed from New York on the 1st of May, 1915. And after, you know, spending the better part of the week crossing the Atlantic, was almost home, rounding the southern part of Ireland on its way to Liverpool when it was sunk by a German submarine and sank within just a matter of minutes. I think it sank within 12 minutes or so. It had been steaming at full speed, basically. And so right around 1,200 people lost their lives, including a lot of women and children and dozens of U.S. citizens. And this really was an event that galvanized a lot of in the U.S., even though, you know, the German embassy here in New York had published a warning in local newspapers, warning, you know, potential passengers not to set foot on British ships, and also made it known that they had set up a counter-blockade around the British Isles. The Germans certainly felt justified in sinking the ship, but of course, the way in which they did it and tremendous loss of innocent life just really was seen as a new chapter in warfare and human history.
Interestingly, being doomed to repeat history that we don't learn from, we seem to be having a problem with fear of immigrants again.
Yeah, yeah. And that is also, you know, an issue that we had hoped to some degree to, you know, highlight with this as well, too, that, you know, the push against immigrants during the early part of the 20th century, especially, you know, with the culmination of events with the First World War and then, you know, the aftermath immediately afterward. There was a fair amount of legislation passed during that time to restrict immigration and also to shine a light on certain, you know, ethnic groups, particularly who were, you know, considered less than desirable and even terrorists, really Italian anarchists. So.
Yeah, I was just reading in materials that had to do with this Edna St. Vincent Millay show. She was very much involved in trying to help commute the death sentences of Sacco and Vanzetti, which is a kind of example of what this kind of anti-immigrant feeling, especially when it reaches a sort of hysterical pitch, can lead to. So does the exhibition tell us anything, either through the medals or posters, about this earlier period in the war when we were subject to these tensions?
Yeah, the medals do. Right after the war started, one of the things people here in the United States did as they were beginning to pick sides in the conflict was to start up a lot of fundraising efforts focused around these multi-day events called bazaars. They'd rent out Madison Square Garden or something of the sort to have a number of food stalls and souvenir stands and things of the sort, as well as various performances and in some cases displays of war equipment and things of the sort. And all the proceeds from both the entrance ticket sales as well as from the sale of various items presented at these bazaars would then go towards charities supporting one side or the other. Some of the items that were produced for sale at these bazaars included some medals and tokens and things of the sort, which, depending on who was producing them and who was selling them, obviously would have one side or the other of the conflict expressed. For a bazaar that was sponsored by German Americans here in New York, there was a small token-like coin that we have on display in the exhibit that features Wilhelm II on the obverse. He was the Kaiser of Germany at the time. And on the reverse is this quote from Horace saying that it's a wonderful thing to die for your country. And of course, you think this was sold in New York, and the country there must have been Germany and not the United States, which was still a year away from joining the conflict.
So obviously one important function of these medals could be for fundraising?
Oh, yeah. It's certainly here in the States, but also in France and in Germany as well, too. One of the functions of these items was for fundraising.
And Patty, how about posters?
In some posters, you do see posters advertise charity bazaars, for example, in New York City for the widows and orphans of soldiers in Germany and Austria and their allies. Yeah, so that kind of irony, if you will, is really, really quite interesting. And it's something that I think the show and the catalog both reveal to the public. By 1917 in Germany, the people just did not want to give money toward the war effort because they were just so dejected and exhausted.
And yes, and they were being starved out.
Right, yes. And so what the central bank did was to consult these modernist German commercial artists who had been making these great modern posters. They consulted them and asked them, would posters help? And so yes was the answer. And so during 1917 and 18 is when the central bank in Germany sponsored posters, German government posters. And we have one of those posters in the exhibition, and it is a very kind of gung-ho positive take on a soldier who has been wounded, and he's standing in the cockpit of a plane.
Yeah, that's my favorite poster in the show. It's of a resolute wounded gunner, yes?
Oh, of course, because you're a pilot, and it would be. Exactly.
So we have two mass media featured in the show, and the First World War came just at a time when both medals and posters were having a kind of heyday. And so I wonder if you each could talk about the history and state of the art of the medal and the poster as a medium in this period.
Sure. The medal itself traces its history back to the Italian Renaissance in the 15th century, where there were artists such as Pisanello, who in a sense misinterpreted a type of Roman coin, a very large diameter, about 40 millimeter diameter Roman bronze coin called a sestercis, which was effectively small change. It was a low value coin, but because it was a large format coin, it allowed there to be a very detailed and lifelike portrait of the Roman emperor featured on the obverse with an inscription and so forth. And these coins were becoming better known and more studied within 15th century Italy, and Pisanello, and others as well, thought that these were less monetary and more, say, commemorative. And so Pisanello began to produce these portrait medals, which were, larger diameter, about 100 millimeters in diameter, which were cast rather than struck, that featured, these really exquisite portraits of contemporary elites, both men and women, with reverses that somehow tied into the deeds and accomplishments and so forth of the person pictured on the obverse. And this new portrait medium then began to just take off, spread very rapidly across Europe. And so, by the time the war began, there had already been about, 3 centuries or so or more of this metal serving commemorative functions and serving propaganda functions and so forth. But by 1900, it also then had started to become more of an art object in and of itself, having to do with a lot of the developments of the Parisian art schools in the later part of the 19th century, so that it now was serving commemorative functions and so forth, but in addition now was its own standalone art medium. And during the war, both of these functions, in a sense, continued and were enhanced. You had, states that were certainly producing propaganda-like medals through, official organs like the Paris Mint, the state-owned mint. But then you also had artists who were expressing themselves, expressing their disgust, their displeasure, their just incredible sadness about this event much more privately through privately produced medals.
And the French academies were especially instrumental in developing the medal as a medium?
Yeah, and the history of the art medal in France particularly was one of the state, such as the state, Louis XIV, the French king, famously saying, c'est moi, I am the state. He adopted the medal as a way of sort of self-propaganda, self-enhancement through...
He was very good at public relations, wasn't he?
Yeah, no, exactly. And he had commissioned a huge set of medals for a histoire métallique, this medallic history of his life and events and so forth, which ultimately numbered in about 230 medals and change. So through the 18th and beginning of the 19th century, a lot of the medals that were produced in France were done so under the auspices of the state, through state mints certainly, but also under these organizations, these academies that had a lot of control over what was appearing on the medals, both in terms of the artistic style, but also, the compositions and, the subject matter and so forth. And it was, really right around the end of the 19th century where artists, again working within Paris, began to break out of this state oversight and began to express themselves much more freely in this medium.
So it was an interesting period for the medal, and it was also an interesting period for the poster, wasn't it, Patty?
Sure. The really colorful, eye-catching commercial poster caught on in Paris in the 1880s and 1890s with Jules Chiffret and Toulouse-Lautrec and several other artists. And that idea became fashionable and it spread quickly. And then around 1900, the flat shapes and very sinuous lines of Art Nouveau and Jugendstil became a hallmark of European posters, and the Art Nouveau movement also informed American posters as well. But it was also around that time, too, that this German commercial movement developed a bold modern poster of these brilliantly pared down colors and shapes that revolutionized poster design and influenced European and some American artists who were making World War I posters. But most American artists made war posters in an illustrational style, which was very, very popular in the early 20th century in the U.S. And they had been trained and they worked as magazine illustrators. So many of their posters reflect this more narrative style where drawing is key. And then the French war posters in World War I frequently have an emphasis on the beautiful drawing of the figure, and that is rooted in the academic Beaux-Arts tradition where drawing the figure is of central importance. But posters were large. They were sponsored by governments during the war, so they were a large, colorful presence during the war. They were in public spaces, in train and subway stations, libraries, schools, parades and rallies, for instance, and they were key for mustering recruitment and financial support.
So there are stylistic similarities between these two media during this period?
Yes, it's very interesting that the two media share artistic approaches of the period that fit and coincide really quite neatly. There is the Beaux-Arts classicism, and there is caricature and satire. You see that in the medals. You also see that in the posters. There is an emphasis in both the medals and also the posters on a more realistic approach as well. And sometimes you see a modernist approach in the medals, but not really all that often. But it's the classicism and the caricature and satire and the realism. Those three streams of artistic approach in the early 20th century are very much also a part of the posters and those medals as well.
Artists can traditionally find employment in times of conflict as propagandists, although at this particular junction, you know, given the nature of the First World War and the rise of peace movements and world socialism at just this time, one would expect a certain amount of critique or resistance coming out of the world of the arts. And of course, I'm thinking here now today about the surge in the arts communities worldwide to contribute to the resistance to Donald Trump and the rise of fascism in our own country. But I wonder, is this the case with medal and poster artists during the First World War?
Yeah, there was certainly an official state viewpoint that the state wanted to be expressed in a lot of these medals, and certainly some of the products of the Persian Mint and statements in Germany did express this. But at the same time, there were a lot of artists who were expressing different viewpoints and anti-war viewpoints, certainly. In Germany, for example, the state had censorship control over a lot of medals that were produced, which meant then that any medal that did not seem to toe the line officially could be removed from publication or distribution. Some medals by Ludwig Gies, for example, were censored in that sense, and you know, he had to explain himself, what it was he was trying to express on this medal and how this did or did not toe the line. So while that was going on in Germany, some artists like Gies and others did produce medals that were a little bit under the radar in the sense that they were more privately produced and privately distributed. And these became, you know, more widely known after the war, not necessarily during the war. So the audiences that saw or held in their hands some of I guess you could say anti-war medals tended to be, you know, fairly limited compared to the audience that had access to, you know, the medals that were expressing more official, you know, line of, you know, propaganda.
Yeah, I wonder if this changes over the course of the war as everyone gradually becomes aware of the horrendous cost in human terms of trench warfare and a mechanized warfare, you know, and the horrors of the machine gun and constant artillery barrages and gas warfare and strafing by aircraft in the end.
Yeah, and there were a number of medals that were produced for the first time, really showing women, for example, in a state of mourning over soldiers. And we do have in the exhibit a portion of a case that does focus on these medals, especially that show, you know, the results of all these men, you know, especially behaving badly, and you know, the effect that it has on the women that they left behind. And really, for the first time in, you know, medallic art, you do get these images of real women, not allegorical women, who are in a state of despondency and despair over what has happened to them and their families.
So, Peter, can you tell us how medals were manufactured?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. In fact, as the Parisian schools were experiencing this rebirth of de la carte in the later 19th century, that they began to, you know, develop new, you know, expressive styles, or new styles anyway, that certainly tapped into the age-old classicism of, you know, the medals of the 18th and earlier 19th century, but then also began to introduce some of these Art Nouveau components of, you know, flowing draperies and these really elaborate types of decorative elements and so forth. And a lot of these medals that were produced in France were using a new production technique which allowed the artists to sculpt in bas-relief a plaster that might be 2 or 3 feet across, you know, allowing them the freedom to really work in a lot of these details and really enhance the sort of sculptural quality. And then using a reducing machine that would then produce a much smaller die or dies of different size, whether, say, 35 millimeters or 50 millimeters or, you know, what have you. And this new technique, you know, also, you know, allowed them to explore, you know, different ways of modeling figures and scenes and things of that sort. Now, what's interesting is that as this sort of French school and French approach really began to take off in the late 19th century, the German had a strong reaction against it. They felt that this approach of using a reducing machine was not appropriate, not traditional. And so a lot of German artists then were producing molds or engraving dies and things at a one-to-one scale and not, you know, it's much larger scale. And a lot of German artists were also casting their medals rather than striking the medals. So there was a backlash, sort of a nationalistic German backlash against this French production technique, but also against this French Art Nouveau style, where they re-engaged with this traditional sort of coarser German expressionism that had been prevalent and used in Germany since the 16th century. You know, you can certainly see in the exhibit, I mean, there's a very distinctive difference between the style of French and Belgian medals, especially, and the German medals that are on display.
So most people, most art historians actually, don't know a great deal about medals. Renaissance scholars perhaps, but otherwise not. So I expect artists who worked in this medium aren't very well known, even to art historians. So Peter, are there artists who came to the fore in medal making that we should know about?
Yeah, in Germany, there were a number of very prolific artists during the war, such as Karl Goetz and Ludwig Mies and Walter Eberbach, and we have examples of their work on display, and a lot of their artistic activity tended to focus only on metallic art. What's interesting, though, is that in the States, and also to a certain extent in France, a lot of the artists who were engaged in producing medallic art were also engaged in producing, you know, larger sculpture, whether it was architectural sculpture or, you know, freestanding, you know, sculpture in the round. And the artists who were engaged in medallic art production here in the States at that time were also engaged in a lot of this activity, especially here in New York. You had artists like Augustus St. Gaudens and Alexander Weinmann, James Frazier, and Paul Manship, whose work still, you know, exists today, scattered around the city, whether, you know, sitting on top of buildings or parts of buildings or fountains or, you know, monumental statues of one sort or another. And right around the beginning of the war, a lot of these people were also engaged in the production of new series of coins for the U.S. Mint, as well as producing medals for various functions as well.
And some of these medals are actually commissioned at the time by your organization, the American Numismatic Society?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. You know, throughout our 100 and almost 60-year history, we've commissioned dozens of medals. Still, in fact, to this day we do it, but right around the time of the war, we did commission half a dozen or so medals from, you know, some rather prominent artists. And, you know, one of the artists featured in the show, one of the U.S. artists, is Paul Manship, who is a very well-known U.S. sculptor, and at the time that he produced these medals for the war, he was starting his ascent, essentially, to a very prominent position as a sculptor. And a lot of the sculpture, in fact, in and around Rockefeller Center is by Manship.
And Patty, posters are also given short shrift by art historians, aren't they? I mean, I suppose part of the problem is that they're such a popular medium. I mean, they're a mass medium. We were just talking last week with Holly Pepe about Edna St. Vincent Millay and the fact that Millay never got really serious attention from the critics. And it had to do with the fact that she was publishing in mass media journals. kiss of death, you know, popularity for an artist as far as critical appraisal or historical appraisal goes. And I remember Joel Smith made the same case about Saul Steinberg, also too popular for the historians and critics. So am I right? Is this the case with the discipline of art history and poster art? It's not really given the kind of attention that other kinds of graphic media are, is it?
Well, there are some museums where design is a key part of the permanent collection, and that's like the V&A, the Victoria and Albert Museum in London. And so those museums where design is a key part of their collection are usually interested in posters. And also historians are often interested in posters. But most art historians haven't studied them. In terms of my own training, I'm an art historian, and I never studied posters, and I'm a 20th century specialist. And so, well, the V&A did a wonderful study of posters back in the 90s on all the different categories. And then also social historians like David Welch at the University of Kent have written a lot about them recently. And there are graphic design historians like Stephen Heller who have also done some work on posters. Two back in the 90s, historian Peter Parrott and then art historian Beth Lewis wrote on the war and revolutionary posters that are there in the Hoover archives in the early 1990s is when they wrote about that. But for the most part, there is not a lot of interest in posters coming from the art historical community.
So last question, did either of you learn anything about your own medium, you know, coins on Peter's part, posters on your part, Patty, during this period covered by the exhibition, from their juxtaposition with the other medium in the show? I mean, do metals teach us anything about posters and prints, or does the graphic tradition teach us anything about metal making?
Yeah, there's no question that metals and posters were often operating in their own spheres, different entities who were overseeing their production, and very often these were intended for different audiences. But, throughout the course of the war, I think there were a good number of points where these two media did intersect. Especially within these fundraising efforts, there were a number of medals that were produced in France in conjunction with this Journée du Poilu, these soldier days. In the States, as well, there were some medals that were produced in conjunction with these bazaars and posters as well. And one of the things that really, to my mind anyway, came out in the course of putting this together and writing about it and thinking about it is trying to understand a little bit better how these intersections were operating, where you had these bodies of artists and essentially administrators or philanthropists or so forth who were coming together and making the decisions about producing these posters and engaging these artists and engaging, the medallic artists as well, too. And in some cases, there was a tremendous amount of overlap, between the posters and the medals. And in fact, there is one medal in the exhibit by a fellow named Max Blondet featuring a forlorn prisoner of war with a pad of paper on his knee, and he's clearly writing a letter. And this medal, in fact, is based on a drawing that appeared simultaneously in a poster that was also used for this fundraising activity. So I'd be very curious to pursue these avenues a bit more to learn more about, how these two media were organized simultaneously and then invented.
And Patty?
Well, I knew that posters were a big part of the campaign for war propaganda during World War I, but I had never studied them before. And I had no idea that medals were such a big part of the arts during World War I. And so this fundamental fact was a real revelation for me. And I saw that also the two media shared these artistic approaches of the period. Like I've said before, the Beaux-Arts classicism, the caricature and satire, and also realism. So I'm all for making medals and posters a part of the dialogue on American art in the early 20th century.
So I'd like to thank you both for visiting with us here on the Library Cafe today, Peter and Patty, to talk about your exhibition, The Art of Devastation, Medals and Posters of the Great War, now on view at the Francis Lehman Loeb Arts Center through April 9th of this year.
It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks so much, Tom.
Thanks so much again.